The meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will please come to order on this March 1st, 2012. And we have a slight change in the agenda. I'm sorry about the disruption. We aren't sure what was going on, but we think we're safe now and don't have to be worried about any other disturbances. Senator Lilly is not in the building yet, and so we're going to start with the photo ID bill. And I want to remind people this room is very sensitive to cell phones, and so we're asking people to turn off their iPads and cell phones because it picks up on the speaker system and causes disruption. Before we start the bill, I want to remind people that this is the Finance Committee and that there has been about 8 hours of testimony already on this bill. And so it's been in the Local Government and Elections Committee where there were 7 hours of testimony, and in the State Government Committee where there was another hour. And so today our focus will be on the financial implications of the bill. And with that, if Senator Newman is ready.
Madam Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
We were told in State Government Finance that this bill would get a full hearing in this committee, and Senator Perry said that he'd already okayed it with you. So we were expecting to be able to have testimony on the policy and the bill as well.
Senator Goodwin, I do not intend to have all of the testimony reiterated that took place in the Local Government Committee. And I sit on that committee, and so I sat there for 7 hours of testimony, and I think it was well vetted.
Madam Chair, that was a different bill. We had a delete all amendment in the State Government Committee, and Senator Perry said that we would have a full hearing in here, so we did not have a full hearing in State Government Committee.
Madam Chair, Senator Perry doesn't control what goes on in this committee, so sorry, but Senator Perry, I don't remember hearing that, but you can speak here for yourself.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. I believe if I go back, and we could probably go back and pull transcripts if we had and wanted to clarify everything. But as I recall, we were discussing about the other avenues of financial impacts that this bill would have. And I specifically remember in my committee we were talking about $2,000, and I kept the focus on what it takes to move a constitutional amendment from our committee to the Secretary of State onto the ballot. Now, at one point in time, there was discussion that there would be $895,000 in expenses. And I said, well, that's for the Finance Committee. That's not what we did in our committee. So, and I do not believe that there was a delete all. There was a small portion that was changed, but we can ask the author that when he gets up here. But that's what we discussed, and we did. I did. Matter of fact, I let Secretary of State Ritchie go farther than I thought he needed to go. I let the ACLU go farther than they needed to go. I was very open and let testimony waver outside of the bounds of the purview of my committee, which was to address nothing other than the focus of how it goes from the Secretary of State onto the ballot and what kind of cost we would have.
Senator Goodwin.
I specifically asked Senator Perry as chair if we were going to get more of a hearing on the bill and have testimony on the entire bill. And he said he had an arrangement with you to allow that in finance. And I said, we don't normally do that in finance. We just look at the financial part. And he said he had an arrangement with you. I'd be happy to go back to the tapes because that's exactly what happened. So if we're not going to get a full hearing in this bill, then why do we think that we need to have people vote on it when we're not even open to having a discussion on the bill as a whole in this committee? Because it has not. You might sit on local government, Madam Chair, but many of us don't. So we have not been able to talk about the policy of this bill because Senator Perry cut us off every time we tried last time. So I really do think that we need to ask people if they want to come up and testify on the policy on this bill. That has not happened yet.
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry.
With all due respect, Senator Goodwin, as I was told by your colleagues when I came into the Senate, do your homework before you come to committee. Don't sit here and try to waste time and take us into the weeds. I am so sick and tired of that. I was told by the majority leader when I first came in, I was told by the chairman of transportation, Do your homework. Read the bill. Listen to other committees. They're online. Listen to the testimony. Don't waste the time here. And I am tired of you accusing me of not opening up what was under the purview of my committee. Please stop it. You're not telling the truth.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair. I think the discussion is getting personal, and I think the truth is that the purpose of committees is for discussion. Now, I don't sit on any other committee that this has gone through, but usually in the past, constitutional amendments have been relatively sacred because you're amending the Constitution that everyone in the state has to abide by, and I would hate to see opportunities missed and a thorough discussion. Now, this is the first committee that I've sat on where this bill has come through. So, to just say that there's no discussion about the content, I think is not appropriate.
Well, Senator Stump and members, we usually have an overview of the bill when it's in this committee, and members have an opportunity to question the author. We do have 9 people who have signed up to testify. We have asked them specifically to speak toward the cost issue. So we will have that opportunity. We will have some discussion among ourselves, certainly, before we vote. But I have allocated an hour for this particular issue, this bill today, and we have another bill on the agenda. And so if we talk too long about how much we're going to allow ourselves to talk, we won't have any time to talk. So I guess I would like to start out with Senator Newman. And Senator Newman, if you will come up to the table and share with us what is in the bill. Senator Newman, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Just as a very brief explanation for those members who had not been involved in the previous committee hearings. Excuse me. Senate File 1577 is a bill for a proposed constitutional amendment that will affect elections. And to date, we've had 2 hearings in Local Government Elections Committee, and those hearings totaled approximately 8 hours. In the first hearing, I was at this table for 6 hours. And during that period of time, I'm going to take a guess that there was maybe 25 or 26 different individuals and groups that came to the table and testified for and against the bill. Then we had a second hearing that lasted maybe an hour or an hour and a half with the members of the local government committee discussed the bill and asked me various questions regarding the bill. We then went to the State Government Innovation Committee and went through another hearing. So this now would be the third hearing on the bill. And, you know, my brief outline of the bill for the benefit of those who were not involved in those prior hearings would be as follows. The bill, first of all, talks in terms of in-person and not in-person voters in the polling place. All in-person voters would be required to present a valid photo ID as prescribed by a future legislature before voting. If a voter is unable to present a valid ID, then the voter would be allowed to submit a provisional ballot which would not be counted unless and until that voter provides the requisite proof, again, as provided by law. The bill also discusses or takes into consideration persons not voting in person. And that would be persons who are not voting in person would protect the absentee voting system. Absentee voting would be, or absentee voters would be entitled to vote upon providing proof of identity as prescribed by law by a future legislature. The bill talks about substantially equivalent eligibility verification. This phrase does not mean identical. Rather, it is intended to give the legislature some leeway in determining what type of photo ID, proof of identity, or other future technology that would be required to prove a voter is eligible to vote, and recognizes the difference between person and in and not in-person voting procedures. Next, the bill places the voter ID amendment on the ballot for the 2012 election cycle and has, if adopted, an effective date of June 30th, 2013. The June 30th date was amended in one of the committee hearings. I don't remember which one. It was amended to back the effective date up to the end of June to take into consideration a requirement involving absentee ballots having to be mailed out about, I think it was 45 days prior to a primary. So that's kind of an unusual date, but that's how that was arrived at. In terms of our constitutional mandated eligibility requirements, everything else remains the same, and just a very brief review of what the eligibility standards in our Constitution currently are. They would be as follows. In order to vote in the state of Minnesota, you have to be at least 18 years of age. You have to be a citizen of the United States. You have to be a resident of the precinct in which you propose to vote for at least 30 days prior to the election. You cannot be a person who has been convicted of treason. You cannot be a person who has been convicted of a felony unless your civil rights have been restored to you. You cannot vote if you are a person who is insane, mentally incompetent, or under guardianship. All of those eligibility standards are already embedded in our Constitution. Those members, and Madam Chair, are the basic provisions of policy which are in the bill, and which went through the three prior committee hearings, including amendments that were offered. I would ask you that you please note that what this bill does require is a photo ID, a method of verifying eligibility, and a provisional ballot. It does not require new technology at the polling place. That will be up to the future legislature as to whether or not they want to incorporate technology, but it is not a constitutional mandate. With that, members, I am prepared to go on to discuss fiscal consideration of the bills, because I think, at least I assume, that's was the purpose of why we were going to be here today. But I will await your instructions whenever you want me to start talking about fiscal information that has been provided to date, Madam Chair. I will do so.
I believe that we could take up the fiscal note that we have received on it. And one of the reasons, members, that we brought this bill to this committee is because a local impact note was requested. And we know that the constitutional amendments cost $2,000. And typically, that's a negligible amount, and we might not have even heard that bill. But we were anticipating something of a local fiscal, a local impact. And we do have a note on that. And we also have the one from on the amendment question itself, which is the $2,000. And then we tucked one in that also includes, I think it's here, the local impact note. But it's very similar to last year's fiscal impact note that was prepared for the bill that was put together and passed by the legislature last year and then subsequently vetoed by the governor. And quite frankly, without knowing about the passage of this amendment, they have stated that it is very difficult. It says, in order to provide you with a range of possible local government costs, if this were to be, this bill were to become law, we have attached two local impact notes. But they noted that it's very difficult to provide a formal local impact estimate because this bill on this bill because it does not include specific administrative provisions that would define local government duties if the amendment were to pass. So there are very many unknowns and potential future impacts that we don't know about because the enabling language would not be passed until after the amendment was passed by the voters. And so we can look at some of those potential costs and what Senator Newman's intent would be of what those might be, but we really don't have any solid fiscal note on this. And it is speculation, so it's simply advisory, but it's public knowledge that people might want to have, and you know, going into a campaign as to what the intent is for this bill. So, Senator Newman, would you explain what you would intend that the bill would include, or if the enabling language were to be enacted today? You might want to speculate, would it look like last year's bill, which this fiscal note is prepared toward, or what would be the intent?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have comments both regarding the fiscal note dated February 16th and the letter from MMB dated February 29th, ostensibly to address the local impact. And it would be my intent, and I acknowledge that the local impact, or I'm sorry, the fiscal impact on the state of Minnesota does carry a $2,000 cost, and according to the fiscal note, that would relate to the reporting of votes cast, the canvassing results, and the preparation of the ballots. I would also indicate that on page 3 of the February 16th fiscal note, there are some assumptions of expenditures for local government costs of $104,000, and I think that we have to be mindful of mandates that we impose upon local governments. And I agree that this legislation is going to cost local governments some money, and but I guess I feel that $100,000 imposed upon local governments to implement or put this matter on the ballot is not an unreasonable sum. And I would ask that the members take into consideration the importance of a constitutional amendment balanced against a $100,000 statewide cost. Now, the fiscal note also, if you go to the middle of page 3, it begins with, if several constitutional amendments are put on the ballot, local election officials may need to provide voters with a second ballot. And in that regard is coming up with a cost of in excess of $800,000. And my position is that that $800,000 figure is purely speculative. And I say that because right now there is only one constitutional amendment that is on the ballot. And it would be pure guesswork on the part of anybody as to whether or not a third or a fourth constitutional amendment is going to be added to the ballot in 2012. Right now we've got one. We are now considering two. And in my world, two does not equal several. Next on the fiscal note, we go to what they are talking about is long-term fiscal considerations. And my thoughts would be this, is that when I read this fiscal note, it seems to me that the Secretary of State's office has provided to the individual who prepared this fiscal note some inconsistent and inaccurate assumptions. And those assumptions would be as follows. First of all, it assumes a bill similar to the Senate File 509 bill from the 2011 session would be passed by the legislature. I don't think this assumption is accurate in any measure for two reasons. Number one, many of the legislatures that voted on the bill in 2011 are not going to be in the legislature in 2013. Therefore, it just seems to me that this assumption that a bill is going to be similar to 509, Senate File 509, is being based on a yet-to-be-determined legislature and on a bill that is yet to be drafted. And to me, that is absolute pure speculation and guesswork. The long-term costs also, near the bottom of page 3, talks about identical eligibility verification. That is outdated language. We have now gone to substantially equivalent language. So there again, we've got an assumption in the fiscal note that is incorrect. On the top of page 4 of the fiscal note, it indicates that the fiscal note assumes elimination of election day registration, resulting in additional cost. This premise is simply not true. The bill that I am proposing specifically provides for provisional balloting, which, according to the United States Supreme Court, resolves the problem of same-day registrants coming to vote without a valid ID. Now, I acknowledge that HAVA is going to be required to implement a tracking requirement for provisional balloting. But given the fact that we already track absentee balloting, and the fact that I believe HAVA funds are going to be available for this purpose, I simply don't see this as being a significant or substantial burden on local governments. Next, I want to talk about the letter from MMB.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, just to that point, so we're allowed to use federal money for this purpose?
I'm sorry, Senator Cohen.
So we're allowed to use federal money for this purpose?
Senator Newman.
Federal dollars, federal tax dollars.
Yeah, I have been told, and it's my understanding, that there are federal HAVA dollars that have been or will be submitted to the state of Minnesota, and one of the purposes that the HAVA dollars can be used for would be for a tracking system. Now, I could be wrong, and if I am, pointed out, but that's what my understanding is.
Madam Chair, I raise the point. This isn't directed towards Senator Newman because I'm not sure that at least I've not heard him articulate that this posture, but I thought one of the mantras around this place was the utilization of federal dollars was unconstitutional. We should quit using federal dollars. It was an imposition on state governments and so on. So I just think that kind of flies. Again, I'm not suggesting Senator Newman has said that, but it just seems to me that flies in the face of what I've been hearing for the last year or so. So,
Senator Cohen, you didn't hear that from the finance chair.
Madam Chair, I was not necessarily saying as to which senator or state politician I've heard that from. Let me make it clear. I don't think I've heard that from the finance chair either, but I've heard a lot of that articulated around here, and so I just make the comment in a general way, not directed toward any individual, except maybe a couple.
And Senator Newman, I believe that even in last year's bill, that some of the HAVA money was used for voter education in particular, so we know that is an eligible use. I'm not sure when Secretary Ritchie comes up, he could tell us what else that money could be used for.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Cohen.
Before we leave that, excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we leave the long-term fiscal considerations, that's where you were just a second ago. That second paragraph under the long-term fiscal considerations, and I don't understand it correctly, but one of the things that we have worked very hard at, in fact, it actually started up in northwestern Minnesota, is the use of mail ballots, mail-in ballots, and part of it is because of the sparsity of people, and part of it is because of the cost of keeping every precinct, you know, open and so on. The mail-in ballots, if you read that paragraph, it talks about how this would be, it says the identical eligibility verification standard, and then it goes on and says that there'd be no way to use these mail ballots as, or even, yeah, mail ballots, and those who vote by absentee, that it couldn't be workable without some kind of a computer at every, you know, that would interface with, let's say, the driver's license or the Social Security Administration. Could you expand on that further? I mean, that seems like that would be something that would be pretty impractical for everybody, every precinct, to have that type of equipment.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stumpf, it would be my feeling, it would be my intent, that the issue that you are raising is an issue that the legislature is going to have to take up and resolve in 2013. It is not my intent to include or embed in the constitutional language concerning technology and what local governments are or are not going to be required to purchase or use in their local precincts. Now, where I come from, for instance, you know, maybe kind of like you, I live in a township of 700 voters, and the election judges are people, you know, that we see on a daily basis. I can't imagine in my wildest dreams that a computer system in Hutchinson Township would be necessary to keep track of the voters, because the election judges know everybody. So, but in the short answer to your question, Senator, those legislators who are going to be back here in 2013 are going to have to wrestle with that question.
Madam Chair and Senator Newman, that's easy to be said, but how would you respond to the issue that mail-in ballots would not, how would mail-in ballots operate? I mean, I have several counties, Kitson County, Marshall County, Roseau County, all of those counties use mail-in ballots extensively, and how would they how would you see that in the future? How would you see that mail-in ballot usage in the future?
Senator Newman.
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, you're not going to like my answer, but my answer is that you are going to determine that in 2013. The legislature is going to be required to address this constitutional amendment if the voters pass it, and the topic that you are discussing is, at least in my estimation, it would be my intent that that would be a statutory provision, and if there are voters in your district that want to come forward with provisions involving mail-in ballots, then it would be incumbent on you to come forward with a bill next year in order to protect them with that.
Senator Stumpf.
Madam Chair, and I realize that this is tied in with, I mean, it is tied in with finances, because if you'd have to have a change the system of voting for
or eliminate the mail-in ballot, I think that would definitely change the behavioral pattern of many voters in my district, and I think others across the state. I think that the catch would be is that this is reading the amendment, require that all in-person voters present an approved form of government-issued photo identification at the time of voting. Well, these people vote from, you know, they have a ballot that they receive from the county, from the county auditor's office, and they vote literally at home. So how do they present that photo identification when they fill that ballot out while they're sitting at their kitchen table? That's the question I can't quite get my mind around. Okay. And if that changes, that means, you know, there's literally thousands of people in my district and probably many more across the state that will either not be able to vote that way, or maybe they won't vote, period. I mean, most of the people that do it now definitely want to vote.
Senator Newman.
Senator Stump, when you talk on mail-in ballots, is a term that I'm not necessarily familiar. Are you talking about, Senator Stump, absentee balloting?
Madam Chair and Senator Newman, no. No, this is for those towns that are less than, I think it's less than 700. It could be 500. Anyway, they're relatively small, sparsely populated areas. But in the case of Kitson County, all the precincts except two towns, Hallock and Carlstead, all of the rest of the county votes by mail-in ballot. And that's exactly where it started many, many years ago, because the county auditor came to the legislators, myself and the House member, and said, we have such sparsely populated precincts that in many cases we don't want to or can afford to open up and keep the precincts open. So they suggested a mail-in ballot approach, which would be different than the absentee. The absentee ballot is a much more cumbersome way where you actually go to the county courthouse and talk to the auditor and get a ballot or request one by mail, fill that application out, send it in, and then the county auditor sends it back. The back and forth process is very time consuming and cumbersome. The mail-in ballot is that they have the county auditor sends these ballots out by mail to these people who have basically the registered voters in that precinct. So this does concern me.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
The best I could answer, Senator Stumpf, would be that this concern that you have would be taken into consideration in that portion of the bill where it talks in terms of government-issued proof of identity. I really believe that in the upcoming session, you would be able to come forward with a bill that would include language that would protect the rural voters that you see as voting with mail-in ballots. And I will tell you that very candidly, it is not my intent in coming forward with this bill to make it more difficult for those folks to vote.
And Senator Newman, I remember the discussion in local government where we talked about what identification people might have to send in with their absentee ballot or their ballot, as Senator Stumpf was speaking, which is sort of like an absentee ballot. It would be a mailed-in ballot, perhaps. And we talked about various forms of identification, maybe a number from their driver's license. That hasn't been decided yet, but it is something that a future legislature would have to determine to make sure that there was some kind of form of identification on the outer envelope of their ballot, so that it would come in with the ballot but then be separated from the ballot after it was checked off. So are there other questions for Senator Newman? Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, all this talk about sending, you were just talking about sending in identification. I don't think it's in anybody's best interest to send in identification. I'm not going to relinquish my driver's license for a week or 2 weeks or whatever it is to go along with an absentee ballot, or in the case of Senator Stump's constituents, the mail-in ballots that have been so successful all around our sparsely populated areas, and a photocopy of it. We've had a lot of discussions about identity theft and identity fraud around this building, and making a copy of something and mailing it in somewhere is a really good way to have that happen. And I don't think that's in anybody's best interest either. I just think this is just sincerely... I know Senator Newman is sincere about this, but I am sincere in thinking this is a really bad idea. I don't think it's been thought out. I mean, if we were honest, we would, we would put in the ballot question that mail-in and absentee ballots will be eliminated, because that's virtually what's going to happen, because, trying to put this all together is just going to be a nightmare. And, we have a good election system. We have worked thoughtfully through our elections law over the years. I've been on the elections committee over the years. And I just think this is when anybody's answer to a question is some future legislator is going to have to figure that out, that's not in our best interest. And I just think the whole thing's nuts.
Senator Newman, did you want to respond to, you have already stated your intent that it is not to eliminate mail-in or absentee ballots. And I think that it would be incumbent upon a future legislature to figure out maybe not sending in. I raised that same concern, Senator Higgins, in local government about we don't want people having to send in their driver's licenses, their original driver's licenses. I wouldn't want to do that either. But we as legislators will have to determine what form of identification or would be required to come in with that ballot. And it might just be a number that's tied to that driver's license and that photo that was already shown when people registered or something. So I guess that we will have to make that decision in the future if this amendment is passed.
And Madam Chair. Your comment that some identifying information is on the outside envelope, that's even more scary.
Well, Senator Higgins, if you've ever voted absentee, there
yes,
are several envelopes involved.
We've eliminated
in
some of them in the past. There aren't as many as there used to be. But still, the outside envelope, never.
No, it would have to be an envelope that could be separated from the ballot, however, before the ballot was cast.
Madam Chair, if I could respond to Senator Higgins just very briefly. Without going into the weeds too far on what might be proof of identity, the first thing that comes to my mind are what are called authenticated documents. It's used in the probate system all the time. So I really do believe that a future legislature will be able to come up with the requisite documentation. As to it being nuts to allow a future legislature to address problems, I would respectfully disagree with my colleague. We are dealing with a constitutional amendment, and I just think it's axiomatic that if the voters of this state decide they want to approve this, it will be a directive to future legislators to implement what the voters have decided.
We'll take a question from Senator Langseth, and then we have to get on to our testifiers because we'll run out of time otherwise. Senator Langseth.
Well, Madam Chair, it's been talked about how a future legislature can set the rules, but how the amendment is worded can restrict how the language would be in future statutes. And I'm concerned about the government-issued photo ID. I was talking to a person who was for this legislation. And I mentioned I had a lot of college students in my area, and that would really cause a big problem with them. And he said, well, that's no problem. He said, the public college or university, you could use their photo ID for their identification, but it says government issued. Now, our public colleges and universities are owned by the government. They are government. If they had a photo ID for, like, Morehead State University, I'm wondering if that would fit this government issued photo ID, so that in, like, next year, the statute could read that that Morehead State University could issue this this photo ID, and that would work. But I'm just wondering, could we do that under this language where it says government issued? Would a college or a university issuing the photo ID be considered government issued?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, Senator Langseth?
Well, if a college or university that is really owned by the state were to issue photo IDs, then could that student vote in that area based upon that, and would that fit the government-issued photo ID, since public universities and colleges are government, they're the appendage of our government? I am really concerned about when you're talking about a future legislature can set the rules, but they have to set the rules based upon the language in the amendment. And I'm just wondering, would that situation fit the government-issued photo ID? If a college or university had the photo ID?
Madam Chair, Senator Langseth, the answer to that question, at least in my opinion, would be yes, if a future legislature so decided. Now, if a future legislature so decided and the Supreme Court disagreed, then a student ID would not qualify. But we don't know what the appellate court system is going to do. So, in my opinion, we simply would proceed with legislation in 2013. And if you believe that student IDs should be part of proper identification, then that's an argument that should be taken up at that time.
But, Madam Chair, you talked about the courts could issue a ruling on it, and that's why it's so important just how the amendment is worded. Some people have suggested government approved, for example, would be better, less restrictive than government issued. So I am very concerned about just saying that the future legislature can set the rules. They have to set the rules based upon how the amendment is written.
Madam Chair, I know there's a lot of hands up, but I really want to get to the testifiers.
Yep.
And in that case, then, I believe Senator Olson had her hand up before, but are you...
Well,
is it on this topic?
It is on this topic, and I'm just reflecting here. I don't know the specific details, Madam Chair and Senator Newman, of the mail-in ballot, but obviously they have to have been registered at some point that they're on a list, because I presume that in each of these governmental entities they have to log in who voted. So there's some identity that they've got a return address on the envelope that they mail it in. If there's a step that needs to be added because of the passage of this, that in the registration process that they have had to produce a valid photo ID, a coding system could be easily attached to the to that same envelope that wouldn't have to be your driver's license number or anything else, but just a code that acknowledges that verification is on record, and then the ballot could be counted. There are ways, and I think legislators, if the people elect legislators who can in fact think and work through these issues, it doesn't seem to me beyond reality that they can come up with legislation. Obviously, we shouldn't be doing it now, because there's an assumption. There's an assumption that it would in fact pass. And the other reality is that the implementation becomes part of statute and requires a governor's signature. And so I think those two steps should be separate, the putting it on a ballot and then the implementation.
Senator Cohen, to this issue, Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, this is not to this issue, but it is a segue to our testifier. So if I might briefly, I know first on the list of testifiers is Joe Manske, and so I expect that Joe Manske may talk about this. I know Senator Mark Ritchie is on the list of testifiers, and so I, before they testify, I just want to say that there has been a concern raised by the public that they want to have some stronger form of identification, and I have seen the options that have been brought forward by the Secretary of State, and I believe that he has worked with Joe Manske as well. And these options, I think, lead us in a direction that is both more economical but also more in keeping with what technology avails us in terms of voter verification. And so I would hope that although people say it's late in the session, that members around this table take the time to really listen to other opportunities, that we don't have to go down this path and lock ourselves into a system that is very costly and, you know, maybe outdated in a short amount of time. So I won't go into those measures because I trust the testifiers will, but just wanted to put that on the record.
Senator Higgins, are you still waiting?
Yes, Madam Chair. I just dug in my purse to see what I had in the way of government-issued IDs. I have my driver's license. I have an ID issued that I received when I first got elected. It has a kind of an unfortunate hairdo on it, but it's still me. The key to the front door. All three are government-issued IDs. Senator Newman, can I go to vote with any, obviously with this one. Could I go vote with these two?
Senator Newman.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, you can if you pass a law next year that approves either one of them.
See, there's the problem.
And with that, I think we will have to move on to our testifiers. We have first up Joe Manske from Ramsey County Elections Administration, and he's coming up with Ken Sulem from the Minnesota Township Association.
Thanks, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Joe Manske from the Ramsey County Election Office, and I'm actually speaking on behalf of the county auditors today, and mindful of my 1 minute and 50 seconds that I have remaining here. I just want to talk about one thing that will occur should this amendment be adopted, and that is this provisional voting process, about the cost that will occur at the local level. And if I can just use Ramsey County as an example, that to have effectively what will become a parallel voting process occurring in every polling place, we presume will require two additional election judges who will be of different parties, will have a whole set of different envelopes, et cetera, and then a process to count all these provisional ballots, which we assume at this point will be about 1% of our total number of ballots that we get will be provisional, and we think we will end up counting about half of those. But just here in Ramsey County, our biennial cost just for that activity will be about $150,000. Typically, we're about 10% of the state's cost, so you can kind of do the math on the cost of that, and that of course will all come out of the levy, unless the legislature does something which it has not done in the past, and that is pass appropriations to cover our administrative costs. Those costs will all come out of our property tax levy. And if I could just take maybe 10 seconds to answer a question that Senator Langseth suggested, and that is, here in St. Paul, we have 45,000 college students, almost all of whom are private college students, and under the current language, they do not have a government-issued student ID card. If they had a government-approved student ID card, that would work, but this present version would not work for our private college students. And, Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Are there any questions? Senator Cohen?
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Manske, actually that was the comment I was going to make about the private colleges because they're all in my district, McAllister, St. Catharines, St. Thomas, and Concordia. So it would be all my constituents who would be disenfranchised. But, Mr. Manske, there's a local impact fiscal note that was prepared by Ms. Kelly, the State Budget Director. Have you had a chance to review that?
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, I haven't looked at it in detail, and so I don't know exactly all of what is going on there, but what I did tell you this morning is just the costs that are absolutely certain to occur should the amendment be adopted, and that is to set up what effectively is this parallel voting process, which would occur in every election in every polling place.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Mansky, the fiscal note suggests costs, the local cost estimate of upwards of $8 million to implement this on an ongoing basis. It appears on a one-time basis, $19 million. Maybe Mr. Sulem is going to be better prepared to testify to the statewide impact of the fiscal note. But I'd be curious, Senator Newman, listening to Mr. Mansky and his concerns about Ramsey County and the impact on property taxpayers. Do you have any disagreement, Senator Newman, with the local fiscal note, the impact note, as prepared by Ms. Kelly? And if you do disagree, where do you disagree? And if you don't disagree, do you anticipate that this would be a property tax issue? And to suggest that a future legislature will decide that, you know, we're going to continue in deficit. The forecast yesterday suggests an ongoing deficit of $1.1 billion. Commissioner Showalter and Dr. Stinson yesterday emphasized again the structural imbalance of our budget. So the budget problems have not gone away at all. We have the school shift that has to be paid back. So assuming we continue in deficit of anywhere from $1 billion to $3 to $4 billion, are you prepared to say that this will be paid out of general fund? Or do you disagree with the local impact note prepared by the budget director?
Senator Newman, do you want to respond?
Be happy to. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Cohen, I have significant disagreements with the local impact statement that was prepared and is in the letter dated February 29th. First of all, I would bring the members' attention to the first paragraph, which starts out by saying a formal local impact estimate cannot be completed. And it goes on to say that it is going to give a range of possible local government costs. It takes into consideration for purpose of extrapolating on a statewide basis two surveys that were sent out. One was sent out to, the first one was sent out to 10 units of government, seven of which responded. And the second survey was sent out to 10 units of government, five of which responded. And included in those surveys were a question as to the cost relating to poll book storage, maintenance, insurance, additional poll book requirements, none of which are in this bill. And I will tell you, in the first survey, 91% of the costs that were incurred and extrapolated into statewide costs involved the poll books, the electronic poll books. And in the second one, it was 98% of the costs that are involved in this letter that came from MMBA yesterday. So I think it could be fairly argued that the letter dated February 29th from Minnesota Management and Budget is between 91 and 98% inaccurate. And I will tell you, Senator Cohen, that, you know, in a different life, if you and I were sitting across the council table, this document would never be shown to the people who are considering the evidence, because it is absolutely speculative and guesswork as to what is going to occur in the future. And I can't if I tried to introduce this, Senator Cohen, you would fight me tooth and nail to keep it out of evidence. And the reason is the same as the reason as to why it is not valid here today is there is just no basis. There's no foundation for it. It's inaccurate. It's pure guesswork. So do I disagree with this most recent local impact statement? Most assuredly I do.
Madam Chair.
And Senator, actually, the preparer of the local fiscal impact note says that it cannot really be completed because of the uncertainties. And so I guess Senator Newman is correct in saying that. I mean, it's not inaccurate on purpose. It's just inaccurate because there's so much unknown. And we are trying to get to it. Mr. Mansky is talking about what he expects provisional balloting will cost, and I would like to go on with this discussion and find out what Mr. Sulem thinks. Yep.
Madam Chair, if I can just make a comment, and I have some sympathy with Senator Newman. At times, I would like to see the rules of evidence adopted in this place. It would be interesting. but, Madam Chair and Senator Newman, we've had testimony not to a dollar amount, but we've had testimony from Mr. Mansky that he would anticipate significant costs relative to Ramsey County. And let's keep in mind that Mr. Mansky is probably the single most experienced election official in the state of Minnesota, not simply because of the last number of years with Ramsey County, but he was in charge of the elections process previously for the Secretary of State. So I don't know if there's anybody more experienced in Minnesota relative to the election process than Mr. Mansky. And so when he testifies that he says there's going to be some significant local cost, he's somebody who does have the experience and the knowledge and has worked with this on a day-to-day basis for Mr. Mansky. I don't know, would it be fair to say decades or years, or what would you like to say about
that? Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, I have to think about this for a second. In June 4th, it'll be 28 years.
Okay, so a few decades, a low number of decades. But certainly he has the experience, I think, beyond any other election official, I would guess, in the state of Minnesota. So Madam Chair, when he testifies that he believes that there is going to be significant cost, even if he can't testify to the note of Ms. Kelly's, he's somebody who has a broader experience than certainly anybody in this room.
Mr. Mansky.
And Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, another day we'll have the discussion about the poll books, which would be useful even without this amendment. It is a direction we should go down. Likely the bulk of the costs recorded here are the poll book cost, but clearly something is going to be spent. We don't need the computers to do this, but we substitute our time and our staff if we don't.
Madam Chair, just to conclude, my assumption is that discussion will be had by a future legislature.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I appreciate your testimony, Mr. Mansky, and I also appreciate the talk about future legislators. Everybody sitting in this half moon here knows the future. We can't tie anybody down. Future legislators can make decisions that they want to. So I don't know where this is coming from, that this is something new to the legislatures, especially the senior legislators on this committee. But to your question, to your issue of the 60,000 students of private colleges that have, generally I'm sure they have photo IDs, Senator Cohen's constituents we're talking about here, should this pass and the future legislature approves those photo IDs to be able to vote, would those voters then be disenfranchised in your view?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the only way in my view that we could use, for example, the St. Thomas IDs would be to amend the language of Senator Newman's bill to say government approved rather than government issued or something like that. What we would want to do is have a future legislature or the Supreme Court, if it goes that way, be able to say that a picture ID issued by a Minnesota college, whether it's public or private, would be in use. But under the current language, any of Senator Cohen's constituents who have only a St. Thomas ID or a McAllister ID or a St. Catherine's ID could not use that document under the current proposal.
Thank you.
Mr. Mansky, would, if they had an ID from their home state with proof that they had a government-issued ID from Wisconsin with proof now that they were living in Minnesota and thereby eligible to vote, would that not be a possible scenario?
Madam Chair, I believe, again, just based on the bill in front of you, it doesn't say Minnesota government issued. It just says government issued. My presumption is that it could be a Wisconsin driver's license or an Iowa driver's license or some other government document with a photo issued by another jurisdiction somewhere in the United States.
Okay, thank you. Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, since we've got the most knowledgeable election official, I'd like to ask this. Relative to college students, they turned 18 at home and their driver's license was there and they registered to vote. Then you go off to college. The driver's license documents essentially all of the elements that we're talking about in relation to what the photo ID would require. How does a college one match up if they happen to have a photo ID? Do they in fact have? How do you know that they're a citizen? They could register, of course, there with that, but they're still registered at their home. Does the Secretary of State have the capacity to determine whether they have voted absentee at home and then are going to be voting at their college as well? I'm talking about all Minnesota.
Uh-huh. And
also the meaning of the photo ID. I was talking with Senator Higgins about our Senate ones. I believe we do have to be citizens in order to have filed and run for election and earned that piece of plastic with our photo on it. So we've met those requirements, and that card means that. But some of the other kinds of photo ID may not actually document the total eligibility to vote. And I think that's something that needs to be grappled with when they set that statute. I think that can be handled, but I think one has to understand it. Could you either correct me or amplify on how Secretary of State would view that?
Sure.
Mr. Mansky.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, you are correct that that of all the whole constellation of photo IDs out there, whether they are government issued or perhaps government approved, have various kinds of information that would indicate at least part of your eligibility. Again, I think going to Senator Newman's bill, the photograph goes at your identity, and the college IDs that we have, at least that we deal with here in St. Paul, and I suspect are common throughout the state, would indicate your identity in that they have your picture and your name on it. Now, they don't indicate, none of them would have an address, for example. So as we do now for Election Day registration for students who use their ID cards, we have them provide another document that would indicate their address, for example. But even the driver's license does not have all the eligibility information on it that we want, and I think most notably, as you know, following this in the news, that many of our convicted felons have a valid Minnesota driver's license. And by presenting that to our election judges, that in and of itself would not indicate their eligibility to vote.
Does Senator Olson. Madam Chair, Mr. Mansky, does the registration to vote have to carry with it some proof that you were eligible to vote?
Mr. Mansky.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, right now, you state under penalty of perjury that you meet all of the identification requirements. Once we get your voter registration document, we then verify the information that you provided us in a number of ways, most notably by comparing it with your driver's license record. But there are other things that go on as well. So there is currently a statement and verification system going on for everyone who registers in Minnesota.
And so, Madam Chairman, that therein lies, depending on when that registration occurred and how the matchup is with your photo ID as to the need for a provisional ballot to hold until that verification can occur.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think you hit the nail right on the head, and I must tell you, to be perfectly honest about this, I am not in favor of a provisional voting system. I think if you're not eligible to vote, we should not give you a ballot. But we should have, and I think this is where we get to the poll book issue, that we should be able at the polling place to establish your eligibility at the point that you walk in the polling place, and with the proper technology that Senator Newman would concede would cost us a few dollars. I think we could do just that. We could establish your eligibility at the time that you walk in the polling place so that there is no need for provisional voting, so that in my world, that would be the proposal that I would make to you.
And you believe that the ballot question kind of preempts the move in that direction?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, as I mentioned to Senator Newman yesterday, my recommendation to you would be take out the word photograph. I think that is a real problem for us in the future, in that it constrains both our ability to administer this process, but frankly, your ability to modify this process over time as our technology improves. I mean, let's face it, photography was invented in the 1840s. I happened to be in Dubai a couple of weeks ago, and when I got off the plane there, they did not take my picture, interestingly. They gave me an iris scan, and so that they knew when and where I left the country with a high degree of certainty. And I can see in the not-too-distant future where voters will walk into one of our polling places with some sort of a biometric identifier that we would use to identify them definitively. So, again, if you're asking me, I would suggest to you to take the word photograph out of the proposed amendment and to just give the legislature authority from time to time to establish a verification method that I think, frankly, it would be more accurate than the subjectivity of having our election judges try to identify you from a photograph.
Members, before we go any further, I want to announce that Senator Lilly's bill, Senate File 1631, will not be heard today. We will hear that next week at our first opportunity. But I also want to announce that at 10:25, no later, we will be voting on this bill. And so we have more testifiers to come, and I want to move forward and get Mr. Sulem's testimony as well. Mr. Sulem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem, General Counsel of the Minnesota Association of Townships. I believe you all now have a worksheet that I put together to try to demonstrate what we have to advise our members to plan for. I think one of the things that we have to remember is, even though we won't know the actual final implementation of this should the voters approve the amendment, our budgeting process requires that we start planning now. We actually have our town meetings in 2 weeks that sets the levy, and yes, there are ways that they can modify it throughout the year, but that's the process we're in. Cities and counties are in the same thing. We have to plan now if we're going to have a 2013 implementation date to try to figure out how to budget for it. And so what I put together was an attempt to demonstrate the types of costs that we know have to be there and the types of costs that we expect that, because we've got a 2013 implementation date, you at least have to plan for. Perhaps some of these numbers won't reach the maximum. Perhaps some will not have to be used. But you have to budget for them in anticipation. Because this is such a substantial change to the election process, we are going to have to do very substantial training of our election judges. Traditionally, that is done in the even year. And we've got a process worked out with the counties and Secretary of State where we absorb much of the costs. We wouldn't be able to do that for this bill. We'd have to do special training. So if you just look at the training, making assumptions based on current provisions for how to do election training, election judge training, chief election official training, for March elections, you're going to add a couple hundred bucks easily to do that. Having to train them now for any special election that would occur after the effective date. In consulting with my colleagues, it does appear that there's no way we're going to be able to have provisional balloting, even though the statute doesn't currently say anything about how many judges will be required. It looks like you'll end up needing an election, a special judge to monitor that area so that those ballots do not get mixed into the general portfolio of the normal ballots. And so there's going to be a cost with that. There may be an actual specific ballot required. Again, we don't know. That's going to be up to the legislature. If it's going to be a special color, special printing, special markings. At the very least, there will have to be special envelopes, and so I built that into the cost factor based on some I'll admit, very unscientific, but just some word-of-mouth costs that were being shared with me, trying to, again, for demonstration purposes, show what that would cost. A couple of clerks at the city level did some checking and said that the ballot boxes are running approximately $100 a piece for a secured ballot box. Because it's provisional ballots, in order to make provisional balloting work, the voter has to have a time period where they can come back and prove their identity. Because most townships do not have business hours, we would have to create business hours for some period of time, whether it's the 3 days, 10 days, whatever the legislature were to decide. Again, we took a very conservative $10 per hour for clerk pay. I think that is a very conservative estimate, but building that in, you could be looking at paying your clerk somewhere between $90 to $300 extra for that alone. Then if a ballot is cast, you've got to bring in the election judges and process them. Again, when and how often will depend on the legislation you pass, but if we look at last year's bill, that could be a nightly occurrence, and so you could be having several hundred dollars of cost. Although there is a great deal of unknown, I feel it's my obligation to let our members know if you want to be ready, if you want to plan ahead, you're going to need a budget, probably a minimum of an extra $1,000 and maybe over $2,500 per township per March election. And that could end up being a cost of $1.2 to $3.1 million statewide for the 1,200 and some townships currently doing March elections. Many of these costs would be duplicated for November elections when you have to, it's a little harder to judge our share of that expense because there is so much commingling with the counties in running a state election. But again, we want to get these numbers out here to show what we have to plan for, what we have to budget for, particularly with the 2013 implementation dates. We have to do something now, not knowing all the details that could come later.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem.
Madam Chair, if I just one thing I did want to, that I realized I just missed, and that is an issue that Senator Stumpf issued. We do share a great concern, not because of the intent of the senator, not because of the intent of his House counterpart to do it with mail balloting, but when you have a provision locked in the Constitution and you can't change the Constitution by statute, I think that's been stated many times by many of the members here, that says it has to be substantially similar verification. We are very concerned that a lawsuit will be filed and that not by any action of yours to do away with mail balloting, but that a court would say that statute cannot provide substantially compliant verification and therefore the courts will be forced to enforce the Constitution over statute and mail balloting goes away. Which would be an extreme hardship and cost. So I just wanted to flag that as a risk we have to acknowledge.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem. Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, just quickly for Mr. Sulem, have you had a chance to review the local impact notes?
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, I have just briefly looked at the fiscal note. Our members were not part of the survey. I don't believe March costs were included in that fiscal note. While Senator Newman may have some very valid points because of the way the bills have changed over time as to, you know, what parts are valid or not, I would argue it's probably an underestimate because there's a number of factors in elections that were not taken into consideration.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Sulem, at least in terms of your representation of your members, obviously, if we don't provide the general fund dollars from whatever source, it goes back to the property taxpayers.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, because we do not receive general state aid other than gas tax dedicated to roads, our costs have to be a direct levy increase, so it would be a property tax increase if they don't have some other reserve to pay for it.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem. And Mr. Mansky, we need to move on to Secretary Ritchie now. And all of our testifiers, shorten up your testimony as much as possible, please, if we're going to get you on here.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, Senator.
Welcome, Secretary Ritchie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for this opportunity. And I want to first thank Senator Newman, who took quite a bit of time this past week to walk me through the latest version of the bill. The fiscal note that you have was at the request for the bill as introduced, and we haven't been asked to update that. So it was very helpful for me to get a rundown from Senator Newman, his thoughts and expectations of these three big sections that we've been discussing: the creation of a new provisional ballot system, the substantially equivalent eligibility verification, which is a very important change because identical is a much more complicated, perhaps impossible standard, And third, the provisions for how the proof of identity and the photographic identification would be provided. Let me be brief because you are on a tight timeline. Senator Newman said earlier that he did not see necessarily a technology component of this. And I've been thinking hard about how the problem of substantially equivalent or identical eligibility could be done and achieve a shared commitment that we have to preserve our election system, our absentee voting system, our mail-in ballot system, and our election day registration system. Senator Newman and I share a commitment to a lot of different goals around election integrity, and we talked about this, but especially around the question of election day registration. This is very important, and so how to do that. It was suggested earlier that we could do this without technology by having all of those election day registration ballots become part of the provisional system. This is possible, but it's 550,000 ballots in a presidential year. The cost of putting 550,000 ballots in with all the other provisional ballots that will come, because keep in mind, a provisional voter would be somebody who lost their wallet and had not received their duplicate. It might be one of the 84,000 people who, at the moment, do not have an ID but have been voting some since Roosevelt. It would be some portion of the 131,000 people who have the wrong address or people who just gave up on their driver's license. It also could be somebody who's in the wrong polling place. In fact, nationwide, that is by far the most used purpose of a provisional ballot is somebody's in the wrong place and there's an argument, oh, I'm in the right place, and they use provisional. So add your same-day registration, 500,000 or more, to whatever is coming in the provisional voting system, and you have a big system, and you would need to be educating your citizens because a certain portion of those ballots will not be filled in properly. Absentees, even as much as we've been doing this for since the Civil War, we still have 3% making mistakes. And we would need to inform the public of how long they would not know the results of an election. Could be 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, 10 days, depending on which version. So that's a long time. I've lived through the period of telling voters I cannot tell them the outcome numerically of an election. So we would need to be educating our voters. Senator Newman and I haven't had this direct conversation, but I do believe technology is part of the solution and a very important solution for maintaining election day registration, which we all share, and getting us to substantially equivalent. I'm not saying identical, substantially equivalent verification procedures. With technology in the polling place, and some of you have seen some examples, we can bring all of the photographs from the Department of Motor Vehicles into the polling place for the visual verification. Department of Motor Vehicles has photos going back 12 years. So any of you or family members who've given up driving, given up their driver's license, their photo is still in the system. If you've lost your wallet, your photo is in the system. If you've moved and have the wrong address, your photo is in the system. Student IDs are easy to put into the system. So I believe that technology is important. It's included in the fiscal note because the fiscal note was requested based on the bill as introduced. But I would argue and would try to make the case that spending money on technology not only can allow us to meet these twin objectives of maintaining our system, mail-in voting, absentee voting, same-day registration, and bringing in the substantially equivalent verification procedures together and bringing the photos into the polling place through poll book technology, which is very easily available and very, very reasonably priced, is a solution that would bring us all to the same place without all the different components that we've been talking about today.
Secretary Ritchie, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I guess this might be the discussion that could happen next year, too, as to what kind of technology would be available
to use to identify people in the polling place, since we, you know, this amendment, if it passes, would require photo identification. And I want to bring you back to the fiscal implications. If we did do that, of course, there would be a fairly significant fiscal note. I have no idea what it is. We don't have that in front of us. We had an estimate from what the poll books were last year. But I don't want to stray too far because we're on such limited time here.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I apologize. From the provisional balloting component, just the cost to set up the system, roughly $3 million, and then the rest is local cost. If provisional balloting is $500,000 or more, it would be a different cost than if it was, you know, $800,000 or $900,000. But our cost is $3 million for the system, and that includes the building in of the tracking procedure, that kind of stuff. The technology to do the verification of eligibility on a substantially equivalent basis, the language of the bill, we believe you would need to have equipment so that the major database verifications could happen in the polling place. You could not do all 8 database matchings, nor could you do the mailing of the non-portable card, but you could match the major ones in the polling place with computer and some kind of internet hookup. And so we put that cost estimate in there. And then finally, we discussed briefly some of the ideas about proof of identity, and our office handles a lot of authentications. That's a very interesting idea. But as you have said, we have no way to know what that might look like, but we do have some basic information about the photo identification. I've asked my Association of Secretaries of State about other states who do proof of identity. None of them have done that, so they couldn't help me. But I also asked them how many states exempt absentee and mail voting because of this problem. Almost all of them do, because it is so complicated. The brief conversation we've had this morning is a surface look at the complexity of the mail-in voting system, the absentee voting system, the overseas and military voting system, and the federal laws that weave together with our state laws that allow this to happen. So I completely agree with Senator Newman. It is not possible to know what the size of that cost might be until we examine deeply all the laws plus the decisions of future legislators. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Bana.
Madam Chair, and your comments to Secretary of State Ritchie was that we could do that next year, and you know, and that he should therefore keep his comments to the bill. But I think it is quite pertinent because we're talking about putting something into our Constitution, yet we're seeing a glimpse of that there is something else out there that would perhaps be a better and more cost-effective, efficient and more modern way of going than what we're talking about as putting into our Constitution. So I think it is very pertinent to have it be part of the conversation. And I've actually heard Secretary Ritchie talk about, you know, taking people's pictures and what that would mean. And so I think to just say, well, let's do this amendment and deal with, you know, tomorrow, I don't think that's the best way to go.
Thank you. Any other very brief questions for Secretary Ritchie? Otherwise, we'd like to honor the rest of our testifiers and be able to get them up here.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Magnus, did you have?
Excuse me, Secretary.
Secretary Ritchie? Senator Magnus has a question. Secretary Ritchie. Senator Magnus does have a question.
I got a question for you, Secretary. Are these, you know, we're talking about poll books, and I raised this question on the floor last year in the Senate. Because of the questions I had, are these computers available? Where do you get these computers?
Secretary Ritchie.
Madam Chair, Senator, the electronic poll book industry has 4 major companies, of which one is based here in Minnesota called DataCard. The largest is based in Omaha called ES&S. We've met with their representatives and their technical people, both of them, quite a bit over the last few months. And they have helped us determine what are the types of machines, the cost factors, and how they would fit together. Many states have adopted poll books, have also just gone to Dell and bought laptop computers. And in Iowa, I think 51 counties have gone that direction, or they bring a laptop out from their office. There's a certain security question, encryption question, dependability kind of question, so they think through how do you back them up. One of the real advantages of the photo in the polling place is that you could also just do it on paper. You could just print out the pictures right on the poll book, so there's essentially no cost. There's some programming, but there is a zero cost option. Those poll book companies help you figure out how to bring it in, but you could do it without the technology.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Magnus,
you know, this is a confusing thing to me because we had testimony about fiscal notes earlier this year from the auditor, because we've had concerns about some of these fiscal notes that come back, especially when folks have a notion not to want to do them, the bills. But you know, I've got a question here. I'm looking at the numbers from the survey, say $11.5 million for the folks surveyed. But I note when I looked at this that the cost information was presented to the survey participants of $4,239 for a computer, a printer, and the cables and software. Then MMB came in and said, no, it's $19.3 million. And then, you know, Madam Chair, I looked it up on my computer several times, and I looked at all of the big box stores that sell these computers. And I think the highest price one I could find was like $700. And I wonder if we're getting a government discount on this, or where did we come up with this $4,300 here? And you know, millions and millions of dollars when I think you could just go use a HP or a Dell computer and do the same darn thing.
Secretary Ritchie, briefly,
Madam
please.
Chair, Senator, I don't pretend to know exactly what went into their thinking, but I know they were given very specific characteristics of how fast and how big. But I will say that one of the aspects of this that's the most complicated is we live in a world that's pretty available in terms of internet connectivity, but many of our 2,000 townships don't. And so part of the complexity of this is how do we think about all of our voters having equal access, equal opportunity. And, you know, Comcast hasn't figured out how to do that yet either. So we're in a bit of a process, and I have felt good about the fact that there's a zero-cost option for visual verification of our voters. And I also know we could do this year. The other proposals and ideas, no matter when legislation comes forward and passed and then it goes to court and the lawsuits and all of them, I feel like there is a fairly inexpensive and very compact way to do this that I think would be a very important option to consider as an alternative to the complexity of what you might put into the Constitution and then in a couple of years say, oh, you know, that's now out of date.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Magnus, we have notes, to move on.
I know we do, but, you know, we had the fiscal note last year, and it in an outline, the specifications of the computers required. And I went online, and I looked them all up, and I found several of them in every box store that were... I could not figure out how we came up with $4,000-some. When it looked to me like that was about four times the money, at least, that we could spend for the same specifications on these things. So my question, Madam Chair, is the physical and the finance chair or finance committee here, we're looking at physical notes. My question is the validity of the physical notes in that segment.
Right. And Senator Magnus, we realize that these physical notes are very general estimates, and they're not something that we have to accept today because it is based on speculation of what could happen at this point. So I guess that's where we're at. And in fact, this whole hearing is just to get a feel of what could happen, but it isn't to say that any of this will happen. So we need to move on, and thank you, Secretary Ritchie. Jean Sanford from Voter ID Minnesota, and we were going to give people a couple minutes, but keep shortening up your testimony, please, because members will have to be leaving here to go to 10:30 meetings, and we are going to take a vote on it before they leave. Senator Cohen.
I'm sure. If people want to testify, why can't we come back late? Why do we have to vote at 10:25?
They're here today, Senator Cohen.
We should keep on going. and cancel the 10:30 meetings.
We are going to continue with the testimony. Ms. Sanford.
Hi, I'm Jean Sanford from St. Paul, Minnesota, and I'm with Voter ID 4 Minnesota. My mother was a 14-year-old girl when the original women's suffrage vote was taken, and she always had the story about watching the town women. She lived in the country, and watching the town women drive themselves out to, and then they were all dressed up, and they would walk across the plowed fields and ask the farmers to please vote for this amendment so that they would have the right to vote. So voting has always been very, very dear to my heart. But voting, of course, is a qualified right. And my mother had a photo ID for until she died at 94. So she would have always been able to prove who she was. Since this amendment, I'm just speaking to the amendment, is going to literally almost cost nothing to put on the ballot, I see this amendment and the pro movement to get voter ID and the anti movement to keep it off as a huge way to educate Minnesota for maybe the first time and maybe the only time in our lifetime. People are really, really, really confused about what is required to vote. I mean, if I went out on the street corner and said, well, you know, what are the requirements for voting? No one would be able to say. And I see this as an open window opportunity to educate Minnesota. So I ask for you to please pass this on and that it become an amendment in November. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sanford. Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, Ms. Sanford, a couple questions. When your mother was she campaigning for the...
She was 14 at the time.
Okay. And so was your grandmother then voting for the first time?
Well, she probably did after it was passed, yes.
And did she have a photo ID at that time?
No, because it was a totally different environment then.
And
Senator Cohen.
And finally, Ms. Sanford, I appreciate your comment about the education of the populace, and I think that's a valid point. But what is the problem? Putting aside the education of the populace, as to what goes on with voting in the state, what is, in your mind, the particular problem that the amendment attempts to address?
The amendment will leave it up to the people to decide if they want a government-issued ID. So that is really what is going on the ballot.
Thank you, Ms. Sanford. And we'll have Ms. Wayne come up, Laura Wayne, from the League of Women Voters. And while she's sitting down, we'll have Randy Leibel come and take a seat also, so we're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Laura Frederick Wang. I am the Executive Director of the League of Women Voters Minnesota. One of the principles of the League of Women Voters is that every citizen should be protected in the right to vote. We oppose Senate File 1577 because we believe it erects unnecessary barriers to that right. If the election changes in Senate File 1577 were to become law, however, we would advocate, as leagues in other states have done, for a vigorous and thorough effort at all levels of government to educate voters about the new voting requirements so that as many voters as possible would be able to satisfy those requirements in advance of Election Day. In other states that have passed voter ID requirements, voter education programs have been required to make sure that the requirement as implemented is constitutional. A federal court in Georgia twice blocked a voter photo ID law in Georgia because of inadequate education and outreach efforts. Voter education on the requirements of voting is costly because the state must reach every eligible voter and every person who will become eligible before the next election. This is very different from traditional campaign spending, which need not necessarily reach every voter. Voter ID education programs need to reach both voters who already have valid photo IDs to remind them to bring their education to the polls on Election Day, as well as citizens who do not have the required identification to educate them on how to obtain an ID. Many people who do not already have the required identification do not realize the kinds of documents that must be brought to a vehicle service office to obtain photo IDs. With new voters registering every year, especially during the general election years, some degree of education and financial commitment must be ongoing and not just during the initial implementation. Fiscal notes for the cost of education and states considering or recently enacting a photo ID law vary. Missouri, on the high end, estimated $16.9 million over a three-year period, the equivalent of $1.37 per voter per year. Texas, on the low end, estimated $6 million over a three-year period, the equivalent of 15 cents per voter. In the fiscal note for Senate File 509, the election bill passed here last session, they listed a cost of $2.7 million at the state government level for voter identification in fiscal year 13 alone. We believe that the educational program in Minnesota would be complicated by several factors. The language in the proposed amendment appears to implement different standards of identity for in-person and absentee voters. Additional education would be required on this point. Some commonly accepted forms of ID may not be acceptable, such as student IDs or military IDs. We will not know the answer to this question until the implementing legislation is passed sometime in the next session if the amendment were to pass. There would have to be targeted outreach to those groups of voters. Plus, Minnesota would be enacting for the first time a system of provisional balloting that most voters will have no knowledge of. Additional education be required. A recent poll in Tennessee provides evidence of the difficulties with educating the public about voter ID requirements. Tennessee passed their voter photo ID law on May 30th of 2011, and it was implemented January 1st of this year. According to a poll conducted by the Middle Tennessee State University in October, about 4.5 months after the bill was passed, over one quarter of Tennesseans, 28%, said they had not heard anything about the new photo ID requirement. Knowledge about the law specifics varied. Only 51% knew that it would not be acceptable to show a valid ID issued by a major automaker to a worker. Only 32% knew that a valid University of Tennessee student identification card was unacceptable. Lack of knowledge about the requirements will translate to citizens who come to the polls on Election Day expecting to vote as they have for years or even decades and being turned away. These citizens have a constitutional right to vote, and they are your constituents. If a voter ID requirement becomes law in Minnesota, we would urge the legislature to make sure that there are sufficient funds for the purpose of educating so that the Secretary of State's office has the resources to ensure that every voter has the opportunity to learn about the new requirement and comply with them in advance of the election. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And Senator Newman, it is your intent to have, there would be voter education. Would that be your intent if the amendment does pass?
Madam Chair, yes, it would, and I believe it's a matter of federal law. But without question, there would have to be voter education. And again, I could be wrong, but I think HAVA funds are available for that purpose.
In last year's bill, I know that they were appropriated through HAVA. So thank you, Ms. Wang, and we're looking for Randy Leibel. Not here. Okay, William Reichert. And Natalie, if you want to come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm William Reichert, a volunteer with the Minnesota Voters Alliance. I will keep this brief. Minnesota Voters Alliance is dedicated to protecting the voting rights of all Minnesotans. Each person who takes advantage of his or her participation opportunity must not have their franchise offset or diluted by the vote of an ineligible person. A system based on photo ID requirements can protect each and every voter by simplifying and streamlining the process for participating while critically improving the accuracy. I would also like to suggest that an amendment require photo ID not just at the point of casting a ballot, but also when registering to vote. The procedures and systems currently deployed by the Secretary of State for voter registration are antiquated, inefficient, error-prone, burdensome, costly, dilatory, and ineffective. The use of photo identification card by every registered applicant would improve the defects and reduce the cost. Let me expound. Antiquated. Current reliance on handling and storing paper forms would be greatly reduced by the ability to swipe information directly into the state's database. Inefficient. Currently, the information on voter registration application is manually entered. Most of the transcription would be eliminated by the use of a swipeable magnetic card. Error-prone. Typing errors during manual transcription of registration forms would be reduced. Burdensome. Voters are currently subject to long lines to register on Election Day. Those delays would be significantly reduced by the use of an ID card. Costly. The tremendous labor costs associated with manually handling of applications would be significantly reduced. Dilatory and ineffective. The Secretary of State, under the use of postal verification cards to confirm eligibility of residents, The secretary mails significant numbers of these cards months and even as much as a year after the registration application has been submitted. That delay renders the return of these postcards useless for determining eligibility, and the Secretary of State has admitted as much when explaining why so many cards are returned undeliverable to the address supplied by the voter. With a photo ID system, the address would be confirmed immediately or handled under a provisional ballot contingency. In short, use of photo identification by voters will reduce the burden on the Secretary of State and county election officials by streamlining and speeding up their operations while reducing errors and costs and better enabling them to detect ineligible voting. Thank you for the important work you are doing to improve the election system and protect the rights of Minnesota voters.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Reichert. Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Reichert. Obviously, Secretary of State Ritchie testified to many of the points you make in terms of bringing an election system into the 21st century. But let me ask you, you made a reference to ineligible voters. Can you quantify for me in the last 10 years how many ineligible voters have voted? Can you give me a number?
I do not have that data in front of me, but you can. It is actually posted on our. I'm sorry, Senator Cohen. The information is posted on the website at mnvoters.org. So I do not have the information in front of me.
Can you make
Senator
a guess?
Well, Senator Cohen, in 2008, there were over 500,000 same-day registrants that were not. Their eligibility was not determined at the time that they voted. Their vote was counted. To date, over 48,000 of those same registrations have yet to be validated or confirmed as eligible. So I would say there's a good number to start with.
And so you're suggesting those 48,000 were ineligible voters. Is that correct?
Well, they have
That's
not,
your testimony?
Senator Cohen, their eligibility has not yet been determined by the Secretary of State, and we are now almost 4 years after that fact. Their vote counted.
Thank you, Mr. Reichert.
Thank you.
Natalie Cook, please.
Hi. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Natalie Cook. I am a senior at Hammond University and board chair of the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group. MPIRG is a statewide, student-directed nonprofit that has been working on environmental and social justice issues since 1971, including helping students register to vote on their campuses. I come here to offer a brief overview of the court rulings on voter ID bills that have been challenged in other states and how those rulings impact the cost of voter ID implementation and education. Minnesota's current voter ID bill will be highly vulnerable to an attack in the court system if it fails to satisfy three constitutional principles required for these bills by the state and federal courts. First, IDs sufficient for voting must be available free of charge for those who do not have them. There can be no fees, as most Supreme Courts have considered this a form of poll tax. Second, accessing an ID must not place an undue burden on any voter. And third, the state is responsible for public education regarding procedures for obtaining IDs and the legal requirements. In almost every case where one requirement was omitted, these laws have been struck down as unconstitutional. And according to these precedents, Minnesota will be responsible for printing free identification cards for all citizens and will need to continue to print new cards for mobile populations, such as myself as a student. Some federal courts have also required the state to waive or cover fees for birth certificates and other documentation. To satisfy access requirements, offices will need to be set up and staffed full-time with paid, trained state employees in areas where less mobile citizens, like students, the disabled, and the elderly, so they can use mass transit to reach an ID office, as motor vehicle offices are not often accessible to all populations. The last requirement would require massive amounts of money in advertising and education each year to train poll workers to inform the public of the new laws. The costs associated with these changes will add up quickly. For example, the fiscal note associated with House File 210 last year estimated a total cost of $2.7 million to educate Minnesotans. However, it neglected to include the cost of education in future midterm and presidential year elections. And this is important, as Georgia's courts have repeatedly ruled that failing to adequately inform the public will invalidate the law. And by way of comparison, as we heard earlier, Missouri estimated in 2010 that it would cost $16.9 million over 3 years to launch a comprehensive voter education campaign. Extrapolating from Missouri's experience, it would cost Minnesota as much as $17.68 million or more over 3 years to inform our 4.19 million eligible voters. So these bills, when fitted to satisfy the basic constitutional law, are extremely expensive and impractical to implement. Myself and all of those at MPIRG care deeply for the state of Minnesota and for fair, clean, and transparent elections. Emperg believes, and I assume that everyone else here believes as well, that voting is a fundamental right. I also assume that we agree that voter fraud is a serious offense and must be taken seriously. However, sometimes well-intended policies have unintended negative consequences, and we simply cannot ignore the very real challenges that a voter ID requirement creates for Minnesotans at such a great social and fiscal cost. So we urge you, please, take a step back with this bill. Let's look for options that can be agreed upon by all parties involved, both for the fundamental rights of the people of Minnesota and for their tax dollars.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very quickly, thank you, Ms. Cook, for your testimony. Do you know how many students vote absentee at home and also in person at their college or university? Do you know what that number is?
I don't know the number specifically. I know that in a presidential year, Emperg helps register thousands of students to vote in the district that they're currently living in on their campus, but I would be really happy to get you that information. I will definitely look for it this afternoon.
Madam Chair, I just want to make sure you understand. I'm just asking how many students vote twice.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I've never seen any evidence suggesting that students vote twice, and I will continue looking for that and get back to you.
But, Madam Chair, you don't know if there are students that vote absentee at their home of residence and in person, that you don't know if there are any?
Well, Madam Chair, so I've done a lot of work on Get Out the Vote and helping students register to vote, and that's never something that I have ever heard of happening in my personal experience and in the experience of all of those that I work with at Emperg and with the College Republicans and with the College Democrats. So I've never seen evidence of it. I've never heard academic evidence of that happening. But I'll definitely go home and continue looking for you.
Madam Chairman.
Senator
Collins. Madam Chairman, I want to respond to Senator Hahn and appreciate the witness's testimony. I forgot to mention Hamlin, which, with the redistricting map last week, unfortunately, is across the street from my new district. I wish I had Hamlin in the district. I'd have all the private colleges. But, Senator Hahn, I've done a lot of campaigning on the private colleges in my district, and I can tell you every student I talk to, when I talk to the students about voting, they will say, I vote in Virginia. I vote in New Hampshire. I've not had a single person that I've ever talked to suggest that, that's a good idea. Maybe I'll vote here in Minnesota, particularly at campuses like, McAllister in particular, which has a significant number of non-Minnesota students. Yes, there are some students who vote off on the campus, but I can assure you, having done campaigning at these campuses, St. Thomas, St. Kate's, Concordia is newer to my district, and McAllister over the years, I have never, ever, ever run into the situation where some student has tried to take advantage of voting twice, ever. And I've got the private schools. The other area that has significant private schools, of course, would be the legislators from Northfield. And I would expect the same would be true of Carleton and St. Olaf.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonham.
Madam Chair, on that point, I know Secretary Ritchie was like practically jumping up and down, because I think it's important on the record to understand that we do have safeguards in our current system. If somebody tried to vote twice in our system, it would get kicked out. No, you're right. We can't kick something out if they voted in Virginia in here. But with regard to Minnesota elections, that's not just an anecdotal, no, it doesn't happen. We have safeguards built into our system, and it can't happen because you can't vote twice in our system.
That's correct. I think the question may have even applied to whether they could have voted in another state and in Minnesota as well.
Oh, I apologize.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Dan McGrath. Mr. McGrath.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to be really brief here. I just wanted to bring up something about provisional ballots. There's been a lot of speculation on what impact provisional ballots will have fiscally and on the election process, and I'm hearing this number of potentially two additional election judges being needed per precinct. Just to put that in perspective, Indiana, which has a hard photo ID requirement, had less than 6,000 provisional ballots cast in the 2010 election when they had 2 million voters participate. It's pretty similar to the numbers that we had. So we're talking about 8,000 election judges to handle less than 6,000 ballots, or right around 1 or 1.1 provisional ballots per precinct. So I don't think we're really going to see any significant increase in cost as a result of provisional ballots or, for that matter, much complexity. So that's all I have to say. I'll take any questions, otherwise we'll just move it along, right?
Any questions for Mr. McGrath? Members, I have to ask you about your time schedules because there were two people who contacted us after 6 o'clock last night that asked to be heard today. We didn't guarantee them, but if you can stay, we'll take very, very brief testimony from those two. Okay. Joe Gonzalez or Jose Gonzalez. Okay, and Terry McCall. Do you want to come up, Mr. McCall?
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity here. I will be real brief.
Can you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Terry McCall. I'm in Burnsville, retiree from 3M. Have my own financial business down there. I wanted to talk. I did have some written testimony that I would like to submit for you folks maybe to review later on to make it brief here. But basically, as a taxpayer, and I'm also an alum, by the way, of St. Thomas, so the person that was speaking for St. Thomas, hello. Again, because I'm in the financial business, I do kind of look at these numbers. And I see that this past year you folks did a great job in that now we have, it looks like, a large budget surplus. So I, as a person that's concerned about liberty, I can't think of anything more important in our process than voter integrity. And from what I'm hearing, this is not going to take a lot of expense. We've all seen and used cards to identify ourselves in other venues. So I would definitely support SF 1577 and would like to submit my other testimony. I'd be more than happy to give it to you, Madam Chair, but for the sake of time, I...
Okay, thank you, Mr. McCall. So is there any further discussion among the members before the vote is taken? Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, a couple of things. First of all, I just want to, on the record, state what makes it difficult for us in understanding what the rules of the game are. Went online to find out what the discussion was between Senator Goodwin and Senator Perry. I think it's important to state that because the truth is in between. Senator Goodwin said, "I do believe in finance, which I am on. Rarely do we get to discuss the policy because then we are all told it's only about the money, not the policy. I don't know if you have something worked out with Senator Roebling." Senator Perry replies, "And I hear you. We have spoken with Senator Roebling." So no agreement of any sort with Senator Roebling. But we have spoken with Senator Roebling. This bill will be heard. And as I mentioned with these few, a couple of minor changes to this bill, significantly the same, and did get a 5.5-hour hearing previously last year. So I can see how Senator Goodwin would draw the inference, as I did at the time, that there'd be a chance to discuss the policy. Senator Perry did not have an agreement, Madam Chair, with yourself explicitly relative to that. But it would just be nice to know what the ground rules are of the committees. As I indicated in Senator Perry's committee, I think the difficulty is that when we combine now finance and policy into a single committee, we're not quite sure where that line is, and it makes it difficult to have a fuller discussion. So I wanted to state that on the record. Second, get into the bill itself. I've spent a lot of time with this bill. I've heard the 5.5-hour hearing. I've heard the discussion. I've read about this significantly. Mr. Sulem mentioned the possibility of litigation relative to what might happen in terms of implementation of some of the language on a statewide basis. I'm quite optimistic from all the hours I've spent with this and reading it. I know a little bit about equal protection and some of the other constitutional concerns that a federal court will hopefully enjoin enforcement of this constitutional amendment if it were to pass. But this is clearly a solution in search of a problem. We hear these vague allegations. What often is stated is that people don't feel very good about the voting system. They have concerns about the integrity of their ballot. Maybe we should identify those people and just simply hire a few therapists who could maybe try to help them through the difficulty they're having with their feelings about the voting system. Because this is something that I think will have far-reaching implications. It's something that, again, as I suggest, is a solution in search of a problem. We are regressing For the first time in Minnesota history, in passage of something of this sort, I'll speak at greater length about this on the floor. And I'll just conclude, because Madam Chair, the others might want to speak, and we don't have a lot of time. My comment in Senator Perry's committee, I'll repeat. And this is not a reflection on Senator Newman or his motives. This, what I'm to suggest is not the motive he has in any respect. But I honestly believe that if Theodore Bilbo and Benjamin Tillman, and I forgot to mention Thomas Watson, if they were alive today, they would applaud passage of this bill.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The one question I have, and I should have written it down when we had the testimony from Mr. Mansky, was, and I'm not sure if maybe some other member caught it, you know, the word change that would allow some flexibility, and I think Senator Langseth brought the issue up about, you know, if the amendment is tying our hands or the future legislature's hands overly tight so that the options of whatever is passed can, you know, can actually be achieved by the future legislature. And I think it was that it would be government approved, not government issued. And I see Senator Newman, you're nodding your head. You know, I think it would be a lot easier for many of us. I definitely am worried about the mail, the options for voters in more rural areas, because they're currently using a system that they feel very comfortable with, I think I'd want to have that type of flexibility for the legislature to enact whatever legislation is needed to be consistent with the people that are voting the way, you know, currently voting.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may respond to Senator Stump very briefly. I think that you have identified the government-issued versus government-approved issue that Mr. Mansky was talking about. And I will tell you that, you know, when we're, you know, not in hearing, I'd be very happy to visit with you, Senator Stumpf, on that issue and on the issue of the mail-in ballots.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like just to respond to Senator Cohen. I believe that people are here because they strongly value the right to vote. They strongly value the right to vote, and they believe that it's important that we protect the integrity of the process. I don't think that requires therapy. I've had a number of people that I know and respect from my district that have served as judges and have seen some practices going on, particularly in the vouching area, where there's some sloppiness. And I think the discussion of the provisional ballot is that, and the fact that sometimes this registration, you send them off and the cards come back, either the address doesn't exist or they don't live there, it casts doubt over the process. And I don't think that people who have doubts necessarily need therapy either. And so that concerns me, and I think that we ought not to be flippant about a process that is being offered in good faith to enhance the integrity and assure that people get to vote. Nobody's talking about trying to prevent people from voting. It's just being sure that we respect the constitutional provisions of what is required to vote and maintain that integrity. And so I watched some expressions of faces that were, I think, insulted by the fact that you think that because they might hold some of these views that you think they need therapy.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
I'm sure I'll respond to Senator Olson. Point well taken. I apologize because you're right. We shouldn't be flippant about this at all. And there are several of us at this table who've been on the ballot many times. Yourself, Senator Stumpf, Senator Langseth, myself. And of the four of us, I'm one who represents an urban district. And I've had, in my early elections, some very, very close elections when my area was a Republican area. And I think when I came back to the House a number of years ago, election night won by 14 votes. We utilized same-day registration. And we trained anybody working in my campaign as to what the law was and what was acceptable by way of vouching, and made sure that nobody voted, at least in the context of my campaign, who was not eligible to vote. And you're right that the voting system is one that ought to be protected. But what concerns me about this bill and this proposed constitutional amendment is that there is a history in this country of the extension of the suffrage over and over again. If you want to go back to the 18th century, the folks who could vote were white, they were male, and they were landed. Others couldn't vote. And we have seen in the history of the United States the expansion of the franchise. That's been one of the core parts of our history. And a more recent part of our history, which I think everybody at this table would remember, were when people were killed in seeking the franchise. When three civil rights workers were murdered. I've been to that site. I've talked to some of the people who were involved. In fact, I talked to one of the Klansmen who went to federal prison because he was at the murder site. And I tracked him down in Meridian, Mississippi. And that's been the history in this country. This is the first time in all the years I've been a state legislator where I have seen an attempt to take away somebody's right to vote. It's a first in the history of this state, and these attempts around the country are a first in American history to do so. It's a sad day when we regress on what one of the basic parts of our American history has been and what it's meant to be a U.S. citizen.
Senator Cohen, I would disagree that this is an attempt to take away someone's right to vote. This is just an attempt to try and to clarify that those who are eligible to vote. And I don't think that's taking away their right. There is no intent, and Senator Newman has no intent of taking away anyone's right to vote if they are indeed eligible to vote.
And Madam Chair, I didn't suggest that was Senator Newman's intent, but we've been around this legislature for a while, and we know many laws we pass have unintended consequences. That will be the unintended consequence of this legislation.
Senator Newman, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins?
I had asked to be recognized.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if you'll look on the bill, actually, on lines 119, 120, and 121, there are the three things that keep a citizen from voting in this state. It takes up less than two lines. If you have been convicted of treason or felony, unless you have had your voter, your civil rights restored, if you are under guardianship, or if you are insane or mentally incompetent, every other person in this state who's a citizen has a right to vote. When we put roadblocks up in front of every one of those citizens in the way in which this bill proposes, we are shrinking the franchise. We are not letting those citizens' voices be heard in the most fundamental way that our state offers them. And if even one person who is an eligible voter is denied the right to vote through the actions of this bill, we ought to all be ashamed of ourselves.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that Senate File 1577 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Rules.
Okay. All in favor of that motion?
Roll call.
Roll call has been requested.
Senator Bonhoff?
No.
Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Fischbach?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Hahn?
Yes.
Senator Higgins?
No.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
Senator Langseth?
No.
Senator Magnus?
Yes.
Senator Newman?
Yes.
Senator Nenow?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Perry?
Yes.
Senator Stumpf?
No.
Chair Roebling?
Yes. On a vote of 9-6, the motion does prevail. The bill will be referred to the Rules Committee. And with that, members, our meeting will be adjourned. We will convene next week to take up Senator Lilly's bill. Thank you.